give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Mossy and Paul. This is episode 12 of season 3. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. The show does contain film spoilers, so if you've not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first. It might help you understand a little bit better. Now for today's show, I hope you enjoy. Right, so welcome everybody, and tonight I'm delighted to say we are joined by Mr. Liam Mogan. And we are watching we have watched the movie 16 Days of Glory. So Liam, first of all, thanks very much for coming on and giving us your time.
Thanks, I'm delighted to be here, and I am genuinely. It's lovely to meet up with you, and it's great to have a chance to knock off the cobwebs of some of the memories that inspired me in sport way back the years. Yeah,
and like the movie 16 Days of Glory, based on the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics. What was your thinking behind picking this movie?
Okay, when you asked me, I nearly had a bit of a block of, gee, what movie is there? And there were some Coach Carter impressed me. There were some running movies as well. But I'm of a time when the whole ethos of the Olympics, the amateur code, the joy being in participation, an unblemished view of it, whether it was unblemished or not at the times, that I'm a product of those. The first Olympics I can remember would have been Mexico in 1968. A man from Uachtarán, Mick Malloy, competed in the marathon. But the 10,000 meters really influenced me there. Neftalu Timu from Kenya won it. Mame Wulde from Ethiopia was second. And Mohamed Gamoudi from Tunisia was third. Now, the names, the places, and I used to train on the old race course in Tuam, Park Moor, and the number of times with the Jimmy McGee commentary running in my head, I beat Mohamed Gamoudi and Neftalu Timu and Mamo Wulde. But 80, that was 68. 84, there's a few reasons. My club mate at the time, Dick Cooper, ran in the marathon there. A guy I was in college with, Liam O'Brien from Middleton in Cork, he competed in the steeplechase and got to the semi-final, as he did in the World Championships as well, that took place in Rome. And the flag bearer that day was a guy I didn't know at the time, but he has become a very good friend since, the show jumping coach, Jerry Mullins. But I saw this film first. There are various versions of it. And I believe a small film company applied for rights to film the Olympic Games. And they were blown out by the big media operators. But they were given permission to take some film as long as they couldn't publish any of it for 1 year and a day afterwards. So they then had to take away all the whole idea of news, of bringing your coverage, because it was a year and day after. So they hired a guy who had an ability to do documentary, Bud Greenspan. And they decided then to do a series of vignettes or episodes to tell the stories behind a number of the athletes in a number of the events. And I suppose that's what really captured me. It was the intangible beauty of the story that was there, the people behind them, the disappointments. It wasn't just gold, silver, and bronze. They went to their place of training, they went to their country. And the commentator, David Perry, I think his name was, he had the hair rising in the back of my neck often. And while it is dated to a lot of the modern day audiences, to me it's one of the best episodes of telling the story around the purity and brilliance of sport.
Excellent. Was there any, if you had to say, of the athletes, let's say they spoke about or talked about, any of them really stand out to you the first time you watched it?
First time I watched it, Henry Marsh, was the steeplechaser, was the one that stood out, and he's been the one that has stood out since. Now, Liam O'Brien is actually pictured in that one, the guy from Middleton I was talking about. But Henry Marsh was the world's number one steeplechaser at the time, but he bombed out famously many times, and he bombed out again in LA. But the actual episode, a fella joined in on the track, he fell in the warm-up, he changed his tactics, he was sick. He didn't do what he was told by the doctors. He half trained and half rested. Even though it's only 8 or 10 minutes, there's so many examples of a fellow whose head was just in the wrong place. He was trying to be full-time athlete. He was trying to be an attorney. He was trying to be a top family man. It incorporated a huge amount. And some of the pictures, some of the photography in it and the water jump is just superb. Brilliant. So Henry Marsh really, really stood out.
Yeah. He was a real sort of tragic figure in terms of world championships and Olympics. I was reading about it after, like, and what they showed in the film. Like, he just, like, for being number one in the world, he just fell between a rock and a hard place, basically. He just never got across the line to get that medal. He sort of reminded me when I was watching it, and just this might be bad, but he sort of reminded me of Mayo football team. Just had all the talent and ability, but just couldn't get across the line for one reason or another.
Yeah, well, at least the Mayo lads got to the final. He got there, but there was a case where he won the Worlds, but he had missed the water jump. He made excuses. There was another Worlds where he had the race sewn up, and he says he didn't see the final hurdle. He is the world's best. It isn't the first time it was there. But put all together, it's a wonderful story of... Yeah, it's a wonderful story. And I suppose when I saw it first, I expected them then that everything was going to come together. And lo and behold, in Los Angeles, 84,000 people all shouting for him, he was going to win. You might remember too, Massey, a spectator came in.
Yeah.
And he actually heard the spectator. He heard the splash with 84,000 people shouting for him. So Chosha, his mind was just, it was gone.
Yeah.
Ed Moses, you couldn't put as an athletics fan. He went 12 days, 12 weeks and 12 days unbeaten in the 400 hurdles. There's a wonderful scenes there where the camera's on his wife.
Yeah.
He was a big character. Yeah.
That was one of the ones that I actually really liked was the, like, his wife, when he finished, she goes, "That's it, not anymore." And I suppose a lot of time we get caught up in the athlete and the person. But a lot of, like, what goes on behind in the background for the people that love and care about them, it nearly matters more to them. Like,
well, sport is a knife edge. It's on a balance, and luck and timing and fate play a huge part to it. Now, when you're doing 10 hurdles at the heights, I forget what they are, at 13 strides between all, he was the only guy to do that, to be able to do it. The chances of something coming a cropper are huge. And competition is always a struggle. At the Olympic final, there's no messers there. You're not dealing with muck. But the tension, the emotion, the motion, the passion, the connectedness, you know, they're there in their colours of their country. But it permeates right down to place, down to where they come from. And for me, while, yes, there was some athletics and there was some gymnastics and some others there, it was that feeling it gave me that represented what sport meant to me rather than anything since. And I only looked back on a few of them coming here. I didn't want to get an updated thing that maybe my memory, like a lot of stories, was completely wrong. The feeling is warm and great, so I left it at that.
Yeah. The first Olympics I can remember, and I was only young, was the Seoul in 88. But maybe it was because there's so much sport and TV now compared to back then, is that you could still remember some of the names that popped up in 84 that went on to 88 and 92. Like, there was, like, as you said, Moses, there was Daley Thompson. Like, I mentioned Adrian Morehouse in one of the swimming races where he came fifth, but I think he went on to get a gold medal in 88. And then the big one that I remember from the film there was Greg Louganis.
Yeah,
and then what happened to him in 88, then the big controversy was cracking his head and his health issues and stuff like that. But it just, like, Olympics really, as a young person, when you're watching them, really, like, imprint something on your mind and your brain for life if you get into it.
It does. And I don't think, Mossy, it does. I don't think it does in the same way. I often think sport, really, we need our role models. And if you go back to me with Neftalu Timu, Mohammed Gamoudi, and Mane Wold, they were role models. While I could never see them and I didn't know where they came from other than the name of their countries, I could believe in them. They seemed like ordinary people that did extraordinary things. That model has rather changed now. And I think the accessibility to what or who someone might have as a role model, that's been cut off a lot. And they've also disconnected themselves from place and from society. You know, they're parts of pockets and pods even way before that term came up. They're very much isolated. They're like another breed. So we don't get that close, and we don't get that ability to be able to dream that, God, we could be like that, or we could know someone like that. I'm proud that I have friends who are Olympians. I've mentioned Liam O'Brien, Dick Cooper, Phil Conway's there, Pat Hooper, who sadly passed away. Jerry Kiernan competed in that marathon and got ninth in those Olympics. You can never really, well, I can never really be in a room with an Olympian there without realizing that they're an Olympian, you know. There's something special, and I believe we're losing that a little bit. There's a distance coming now between people who perform at those levels and the people they represent. And I just hope that the younger generation have that connection to idols and role models that they can get in contact with, and they can believe and they can trust, because there was an unblemished trust in the idols that we had. They were pure and honest and real and ordinary despite what they did. So that's the kind of thing that lifts the hair on the back of the head, you know.
Yeah, does a bit of that, Liam, come from the fact that, like, children these days now, I couldn't tell you how much any soccer player earned in 1994 when I was 10 years of age. But now you hear soccer players getting X amount of money and stuff like that. And that the Olympics, because of the amateur ethos, and I know, look, a lot of them are well paid and stuff. But does that be a factor that, like, people don't aspire to go to the Olympics now? They aspire to be Ronaldo making 300,000 a week.
Yeah. Look, coaching has been my world, and in somehow we're to blame for that. You know, if you look at Chariots of Fire, which is another wonderful film, Sam Mussabini, the coach that time, there's a lovely shot of him listening outside the Olympic venue to a radio about what's going on, because coaches weren't allowed in. Now, women weren't allowed in, now that's another story. But the intrusion of coaches into what I would call, at its extreme, the manifestation of ego, of people just parading themselves, of notoriety becoming a means of success, tangible success. It has changed our view from the intangible, the passion, the fact that I can look at they're an Olympian, they rode the winner of the Gold Cup. I think that loss of the tangible, the results, what are they earning, what do they win, that's damaging sport. And as someone who was involved in coach education, I wouldn't stop blaming myself a bit in the intrusion of coaches. We have built up ego, and ego in its very nature is dangerous.
Like, as well, like with the coaches and the coaches feeling the need to have an input, we'd say the gymnastics, but when it was a kind of a battle between the Romanians and the US as well. And like there was the thing I find really interesting about the athletics is you have your Olympic coach who's out over, we'll say, Team Ireland, but then you have your coach who you worked alongside all the time, and they're not necessarily there alongside you. So like in that scenario, you had Coach Peters and Bella Corley, and
yeah,
like the dividing line between who is helping, what's the role of the coach. It just does get to the fact that, like, and it just needs to be about that athlete performing at their best. And if you have, you don't need to be alongside them for when they're fully successful. And I suppose we've all of us here have worked in that area where we've coached children.
Yeah.
And we're coaching children for them to have fun and whatever, and to have a lifelong involvement in the game. And if they're successful with, and they get to the Olympics, or they make it over to England, we might have said it might be a success, but if they got over to England in soccer, or they won in All-Ireland, that delayed gratification of us having helped them at one stage along their journey is fantastic. But some coaches do want to be front and centre at the end. Like,
yeah, at the middle and end, Paul. I think coaches should not be seen at all. I'm a huge fan of coaches. I think anyone who coaches, and the vast majority of them in Ireland are volunteers, I think they're already in my mind, they're wonderful people. They're good people. They're committing time, which is real. They're doing it on a very consistent basis. They're putting themselves out front. So I'm a big fan. I would, however, say that I would agree with you. Coaches should not be seen. The day the athlete they help is actually competing, that's the day you measure the improvement that athlete, that player has made with your guidance. And you need to back off. You're no longer in there. You know, they've heard the stories of the boxing coach in the corner kind of said, there's no one hitting us and all that. There's no one hitting us. And the boxer says, well, I don't know, but there's someone hitting me. You know, there is that disconnect. And a thing that does worry me from time to time is that a lot of coaches don't actually demonstrate good practice. The ranting, raving lunatic on the sideline. It's attractive. It catches the eye. And of course, it's copied. And I can compare that to, you know, listening to CNN when Trump was president. Gee, it was like full on entertainment, you know, breaking news, bang, he said something else, breaking news, there's a tweet. There was something entertaining about it, but it was completely ineffective. Real politics now, it isn't as entertaining. It isn't as visible. The whole CNN, boom, 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 breaking news thing has died to death. So I think coaches, while I fully support them, I think there's another layer they have to take on, that they're no longer competing. Back off. Don't be seen there. I'd love a situation where coaches are not visible at all. Not on sidelines. They're away somewhere. Look at my sport of athletics, Paul. In a few events, you have this idea where as soon as they do a long jump or a pole vault, they're over to the coaches. Now, they have a few attempts in those events. They should fix it themselves. The shot putters, the discus throwers, the hammer throwers, they don't go over to the coaches. Something steeps in ever so slowly. Look at how players would love to go over to a coach and be able to go back and play that play again. These athletes that do that in our sport of the pole vault and long jump particularly, there should be no reason. A lot of it, you can see that the coach loves the attention of it all.
Is that just, you think, it's a copycat thing where if they're doing it, we must do it? Or
I do, Massey. I think the duty of coaches to model good coaching practice is becoming more and more important. And I think to use the sport in a way that develops respect and humility and character and patience and resilience, a lot of the things we're talking about now, because no matter who's going through the sport, they're going to come out of it pretty quickly. They're going to get slower. Their physical attributes are going to wane. Now, what have they left? Have they only got technical and tactical physical skills from their sport, or have they been developed in a character that can know about themselves and know about the community in which they live? The coaches that can do that best are ones who can demonstrate these qualities. No real ego, not out there, out front. There's a famous golf guru, brilliant guru. So remember, but I just can't think of his name now. But I'm always amazed that while he helps out a lot of golfers, on the Sunday, he tends to walk with his guy who's actually leading. Now, on that particular day, I think he should be in the clubhouse with the guy who's in bits because he didn't play well. I'm always amazed that he feels the need to be, well, one of the guys I work with is winning, and here I am. So I suppose it's a more holistic view of coaching, Massey. I think it can be done. And more importantly, I think the coaches that do it best are known. They are known and they are respected over a far longer period. Yeah, they get more better results in the end.
There's an element, like there is an element to that. The coach's aim should be to kind of make himself redundant or make herself redundant, that
for sure
their input is no longer valuable to the athlete. So I suppose you start off in that scenario where it is very much the coach on top and the athlete on the bottom, and we're trying to impart knowledge and give them as much as we possibly can. But we want to get to a scenario straight away where the athlete's knowledge and their internal knowing of what they're doing surpasses anything we can give them from an external, and then it's going really well. But I suppose, like, coaches do love to coach as well, Liam, and it's very hard to get to the point where I've done my job there, now I have to pull back. So that is a difficult task as well.
Oh yeah, I think there's two phases there, Paul. There's coaches who were brilliant in training sessions, and there are coaches who are brilliant on days of competition. Now, ideally, you'd like to get the same, the person who's good at both in the one body. But I have seen people who were actually brilliant on competitive day and not necessarily good in training, and vice versa. I do believe the coach has opportunities to have an input, but they have that before the game. They have that at halftime. They have that in the finish at the review when there's more than one game. And really, since lockdown now with the water breaks, really you're talking about in Gaelic games, coaches have an opportunity to step in there about every 17 minutes. That has changed the way the game is played and changed the role of the coach. And as he is now at the moment, that's a formal introduction. But I think a time comes when it's all out, you know, seconds out, they say, in boxing. Get out of there. And I think we need to remove ourselves in all ways there. Now they're in deep water. Let's see how the character of the person we're working with responds in deep water.
So Lehman, saying that, like, obviously in basketball is a really prime example of, we'll say, the timeouts, and they get an opportunity to do it when there's one play in the game left. Would you be in favour of that being removed, so it's nearly all the onus is on the players to do it on the day, and that means that the coach has to do it much more in advance of the day?
I would, although basketball is one of those that's very, very coach-centred. I think now they may have 5 timeouts each, you know, so that's a lot of inputs that they can have. So the flow of the game is interrupted a lot for coaching. I had a very good basketball coach one time, Paul, my brother Morgan. I've spoken about him often. But his way of reviewing or inputting or trying to improve our performance during timeout was to ask us questions. And while I exaggerated slightly, some of our timeouts, I felt they were more uncomfortable than the game. He'd ask me, look, that Paul O'Brien has got 3 rebounds on you. How are you going to block him out for the next one? And I'd be looking back at him like, help me here, I don't know. Now, when he would eventually come in, you were dying for this piece of information. But it wasn't all give, because I think anyone I've really worked with, it's what you can take out of them that really makes them. And you need a patience about that. And you need the patience over time to see them making mistakes. At times it doesn't matter. So that now when we're playing the final, now we're in a game that really matters, the chances of them making the correct decisions are multiplied because they have fought out with this. They've made a decision that was wrong. They made a decision that was wrong. Made a decision that was right and they learned. So you get the more molded character at the end of it.
Yeah, and you spoke about your coach Morgan there asking questions. And is it, look, I suppose it's a confidence in themselves knowing that, look, this is what we're doing. But like, we talk an awful lot about coach education, about getting feedback and asking the player to give you the answers as opposed to telling them. And the loads of fishes thing, or teach a person out to fish rather than giving them the fish. But we still see an awful lot in the GA where it's one way direction. And is that just a struggle that we're getting across? We're not getting the points from a coach education point to the coaches, or is it just endemic that this is how they were coached and how their father was coached before them? And it's just all they know, like I said, is it something that we as coach educators need to do better?
Okay. I'd exaggerate for effect, Colm, and I use the phrase telling doesn't work. I've learned that with my own kids. I've learned that with my wife, but don't say anything about that. Telling doesn't work. Now, there's lots of examples where it does. And like in a timeout, like at a halftime, you don't have time for facilitation here. What do you think? And this, that, and the other. Bang, you have to go. But there can be a balance. There can be a balance, and there can be an extension of what you usually do from training. So it isn't a matter that during training you're telling people what to do all the time. And in the competition, you're expecting them to think for themselves. And when they're thinking for themselves in a way that isn't being effective, you bawl at them at timeout and say, did you hear what I told them? Well, yes, I did hear, but it had no real effect on their performance. They remembered you shouting and roaring. But it didn't really have any other impact into it. So I do believe that that role of coaching competition is an area we need to get into a lot more. There's a sanctity about what happens during the big games. We like to hear the stories. You know, what did the coach say? What did the coach do? And in many, many cases of effective improvement in play, the coaches did very little. Very, very little. Now, there are the dramatic examples of where they threw a medal off the wall or they banged the table and so forth. But look, their stories that just kind of get legs and they stay there. There's nothing really sexy about the coach who went around asking questions and then looked around to see from an injury point of view who had to be substituted, who made big decisions about plays that may be done in the second half and personnel. That needs to be done with a calm mind. There's a huge emotional things like that column, I'm taking you off, Mossy's in instead of you. There's a huge emotional weight attached to that. So the coach who must do that over a season and over many seasons has to keep your respect in the sense that you value that he's doing it for the best purposes. That has to be done in a climate where everyone really is together rather than someone shouting and roaring. I think what we're really touching on in that, like we're on the eve of Cheltenham now when we're talking, and betting has married itself to horse racing completely. It's, you cannot think of horse racing now, but you'll ask about who's favourite and so forth. In most sports, competition has welded itself on in much the same way. And I don't think sport was ever fully intended to be played in a way that was competitive, win or lose, winner takes all, most of the time. We have lost the ability to compete in blitzes. We've lost the ability to compete in just mini leagues, street leagues, interferon competitions. School competitions have got serious. Juvenile competitions have got serious. We have married ourselves to this competitive, tangible model too much. It is not bad. We all like competition and we need that. And I've been attached to teams that won and it's lovely. The however bit is, what are we abandoning in that pursuit of that role? And I think we're losing a lot just in the way that the business of horse racing, the purity of the race. I love these races that are coming up. There's no talk of split times or world records or finishing times. It's the purity of the race, the purity of the game. And we have really allowed the results of the game affect too much of the whole realm of our sport. We need to broaden it out.
You've opened a door there to tell you about social hurling, Liam. It's for old fellas like myself and Paul and Massey to get together and have a puck around, seven aside, six aside, backwards hand passes, you name it.
But isn't there too little of it, Colm? I mean, when you say social hurling, I've never heard of social hurling, actually.
Yeah.
We hear of walking soccer, five-a-side soccer, seven-a-side soccer.
All the same. And, you know, as I said, exactly what you said, it's very much go back to when you started running or athletics or when anybody started any sport, they did it for just pure joy and enjoyment.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like, look, natural way of being is you'd want to win anything, but even if you're playing tiddlywinks against the wall, you'd want to beat the person, but you're enjoying it and
you move on after.
Yeah, there's never a hang up, and like you'd see it with people, like I know we spoke about it a couple of weeks ago with Gary Egan and David Duval, and like when he did eventually win the US Open or the British Open, the jubilation wasn't what he expected and sport died for him essentially.
Yeah,
and everything was to the success of it or the failure, and it's just like it is something that, especially as coaches with underage, and I know the lads can probably agree that we would see that over competitive element, and we always say to coaches, actually, like, you know, don't worry about winning. Like kids will do the worrying about the winning. We just need to worry about the rest of it.
Yeah, and a lot of sports, Colm, have the ability of doing it in small numbers. I mean, you might get evidence now of why I am as I am, but I played basketball by myself for hours, hours and hours and hours. I never managed to slam dunk, but by God, I spent hours trying. There was one Christmas because we had access to the school basketball, which was a reconverted cowshed, actually. We painted the walls, we painted the floor, and we had a key. And one Christmas, my brother and I, Sean, went up and we played for 2 or 3 hours, the thing. And my mother was mortified. What will the neighbours think? You're up there playing bloody basketball on Christmas Day. But there was a joy about that movement, a joy about running. Running was my main passion. And I loved running from A to B on places that mattered to me, you know, or doing laps of a place that mattered to me. Now, someone said, well, that's not, you know, what distance is it? I said, I don't really know, but I'm doing the Ballymadon. I'm going around Cluny Glasha. It mattered. I think we need as a structure to start revisiting the value of these things. We'll play the Crave, we'll play the school next door. And, you know, we might mix the players. I think, what? We'll mix the players. And we'll have a game. We'll have a game of hurling. You get to know the fellas you're playing with a bit more. You get to talk to them a bit more. It isn't saying that they can't then have a very competitive game. But I think we have burned off everything else in the pursuit of this, what is an adult professional copied model in many ways.
I was going to mention something. One of my favourite parts of the film was Daley Thompson in the decathlon in 84, and Hinkson was his rival, and Hinkson was the world record holder, but he'd never defeated Daley Thompson in competition. The time he broke the world record, Daley Thompson wasn't there. And I thought just the whole 5-10 minutes they spent on that was just enthralling, really, to be honest with you.
It is. To me, Daley Thompson represents what I am. He's a boyo. He can think by himself. He's smiling and laughing. He's out there. You don't know what to expect. And Hinkson was your typical German, tall, muscle-bound, stern and everything. But the story I like about that, and I might have it right, Daley Thompson came to a coaching conference in Limerick a few years later, and it was around the 10,000 points, somewhere around the 10,000 points. The decathletes get around 1,000 on each. Let's say it is. He had many coaches, a lot of coaches around, a lot of events. Thompson was really up near world-class performance in a lot of the events of the thing. And when he was back in England and there was a celebration of his chat, the wife of one of his coaches, who hadn't seen his coach for ages, went up to Daley and said, look, tell me, my husband, Massey, how much of an input did he make into the gold medal, you know? So Daley Thompson, being the boyo, he thought for a while and he said, I'd say about 50 points. And she was gravely insulted, 50 points over 10,000. So she went to the husband there and then and said, look, I haven't seen you for ages. He said, it's only 50 points. So the husband went to Thompson a while later and Thompson gave a great answer. He said there were the 50 points that made the difference. That was the input he made. And I think it was a great answer around coaching that, look, I can do so much. I'll get 9,000 points, but your husband can help me get an extra 50. Now, that's what I love. But to me, Thompson represents a lot of what we have lost in athletics. We have lost the characters. We have lost the boyos. We have lost the people who can think for themselves. They now have to think the way they're supposed to think, look the way they're supposed to look, or else they're ostracized. Thompson was one of the Dave Wattle who wear the hash and the ear in the Moscow Olympics of Munich Olympics of 72. We don't have many. Paul Donovan, I'm talking a little bit of athletics now, he got a silver medal in the world indoors to Frank O'Mara, a Galway guy. And he used to don't know whether he's ever heard this, but he used to dress a little bit sloppy in the running gear. And in Ards Carriche, where I had, we had a Paul Donovan day every now and then where fellas wore sloppy gear. Now, we still did our running, but there were all kinds of stuff. It was just an expression of their personality. Just let's see what happens, you know. So, yeah, I can see where there's something crazy about the decathletes. And, you know, they also have a great, they compete against themselves. They're a group. You'd see them support each other. You'd see them help each other. You don't see that in a lot. And even in the indoors in Poland there last weekend, before the multi-eventers came out for their 1,000 meters, they were chatting to themselves. They were the high jumpers. But they have this idea that the competition is against me, not against you. I need you to make it exciting. But let's get in there and compete. Yeah, but Thompson is a magic guy, yeah.
That's something we kind of referenced before as well, in that in the GA, like, if you don't know the fella down the road, he's an awful. You can use whatever curse word you want, but in those sports, like in the Olympics in particular, like, is it because it's just such a small group? Like they have to spend so much time. Like, I'm just thinking of the pole vaulter there now, the French fella. Geez, he must have been sitting down his arse for probably 3 hours while the event was ongoing, and in his own head going, "Yeah, I'll skip this one. I can't. I've only got 5 jumps or 6 jumps."
Yeah,
and tactically to be able to keep himself engaged throughout all that must be. Like, yeah. It must be unreal.
Yeah, athletics doesn't serve itself well in the way it chops and jumps in its presentation of the events. You're watching a race and suddenly it goes to one jump or throw, goes back to the race while other throws. They're intriguing. They're the essence of really a slow motion competition. Decisions are coming. Some person goes ahead, next person goes ahead, next person breaks. There's a beauty about it. But in its best column now, and they have extremes as well, I'm not pointing them, they see their competitor in the main, I think, as someone who's vital for the race or the event to take place. They don't see them as an enemy. They see them as someone who's going to stretch them, to extend themselves to their best of their ability. They have this idea of a PB, a personal best. And I think it's a healthier way, rather than sometimes in team sports, we use language of battle and war, an enemy and that kind of thing. And we have this division type of thing that isn't always best. There might be a level of which we evolve to a very tense situation in adults at professional sport. I don't believe it would be best, but it could evolve to there. But jeepers, that has dripped down, dripped and dripped and dripped to fairly low age groups now where that kind of thing is there. And I think the purity, again, I've mentioned that, the purity of the reason of the competition. I need you to see how I have improved at my training when you weren't around. Without you, it won't happen. So I should value the fact that you were there.
And just saying that, I actually, my two nephews are playing yesterday. One's 4, the other's 7 now. And they've got friends 2 doors down, and one is 7 and the other is 5. And I know that the two boys, whenever they're playing out in the road, soccer or football or whatever, the two older fellas go together against the two younger fellas, and they hammer the crap out of them. But eventually it comes to a stage where the two young fellas will go, "We're not going to play anymore. It's not fair." And the older fellas then will fix the teams to correct it for that self. We need an opponent. We need people to play with. And like what you're saying there is just ringing in my head there, that it's gone back to the basic. It's gone back to the very basic level of sport. Like,
it is, Colin, but they're people who are taking risks. They're solving problems. They're innovators. They're thinking in the goal. They understand fair play. They don't really want them to be playing sport and scoring 10 goals when the others score nothing. They want the challenge. They want that company. They want that challenge. And sport does provide us with a choice. It provides us with a challenge. And it provides us with a measure that's personal to ourselves. And if we re-engage with that aspect of it all the more, I think it will be attractive to more. It can make a far more vibrant contribution to all societies rather than a select few who are actually selected. You know, in order to play in a team sport, you've got to be selected. In order to coach, you've got to be selected. Individual athletes have a greater freedom. You know, I can compete in the Dublin City Marathon. You can cycle in more cycle races. There was a time you could just walk in and enter the World Sailing Championships if you had the money and a boat. There isn't that in team sports. So we need to broaden it out a wee little bit.
Just a memory from my childhood kind of sparked up there with something you said, Colin. I remember playing soccer on the green, and there was one particular green we played on, and it was just whoever got the 3 or 5 first won. But then we went around a corner and we played a match against 2 older lads, and we were given a 2-0 head start up to 5. But we bet them, so we bet them 5-4.
Yeah.
But they came with the caveat then. We're taking one of the goals back, and then we scored an excellent. Right now we're playing for a winner, because the game had been evened to start with. They thought we were 2 goals. They thought we needed a head start.
Yeah.
we got to a level where there was parity, and then they took the rug from under us, which I think, which looking back on it, we thought we were brilliant, but it was a great way to make sport and success achievable kind of for everyone at that particular stage, which was great. And like, even like, I actually watched an awful lot of the European Indoor Championships, and I like the fact that success wasn't necessarily built on coming first, second, or third, because that's how I would have viewed athletics, is you come first, second, or third, or you're absolutely nowhere. But like, people are coming, like, and Phil Healy, for example, came fourth in her race by a quarter inch or whatever it was, but it was a PB, and she ran as well as she possibly could. So she is leaving there buoyant and really happy, even though the way we're meant to view sport is she wasn't successful, but she was. And that's, I found it really interesting. But then from the other side, looking at some of the athletes, and they don't achieve their PBs, and like, so obviously there was a lot of the Irish 800 meter girls had kind of broken their own records in the lead up to the European indoors, but none of them achieved as much as they had on the day, like Nadia Power or Shifra. They didn't get the times they had, and I just find it fascinating that, like, that's the big day. Mm-hmm. Well, not the big day, I suppose. Look, they're striving, and I know Nadia as well, on course, to get to the Olympics. But I just found it fascinating, the different. I would have seen athletics very, very linear, mm-hmm. until I actually watched this film, and then watched the European indoors, because there wasn't a whole lot of other sport to be watching. And I don't mean that as bad to athletics, but I mean it that I have just much greater appreciation of it in the last month.
But look at, Paul, the two examples you gave there, the example of the playing in the green and changing the teams and having the scores and 5-4 bartering for the rules. And now for the formal athletic scene, coaches, while I'm fully supportive of them, coaches weren't present in either of those occasions. And when you talk about someone within athletics having a personal best, they're actually going and completing a performance that was never done before. So the coach is away now, they've done it alone. And I like music, but when I'm going to a concert, I'm conscious, I see the performer. I see them there, the lights and everything are geared for them. But there's a whole technical team that's making that possible. The videos, the lights, the backing tracks, the sound. You never see them. You know, you think everyone in a black jacket and long hair might be one of that, but you never see them. Now, that's where I'd like to see the coaching going. And sometimes I feel, again, if I use that analogy, if I go to a concert, I may like, oh, they're playing the song I like most. And of course, it's the performer. I love the performer as well. It's very seldom I go away talking about the singing. And the singing is my real analogy for the coaching. We've got caught up in, well, what's the singing? Are we going to be the grammar right? Is the tempo going to be right? Is the beat going to be right? Is the start, middle, and end? Oh, hell, just go sing the song. Just sing the song, you know? We love the occasion. So it's not in any way decrying the role of coaching, because I think it is immensely valuable. But I think it's like Lanigan's ball. You step in and you coach. You do your absolute living best to help. And you back the hell out of it then and disappear. You're a technical person. Go make sure the lights work. Go make sure the sound is going to work. Let they who are up front take part. And I think it was a team example you gave down the yard and playing the football or wherever. And then a high standard individual events. In both contexts, the sports, the coaches had done their bit and then handed over to the athlete.
Just from a GA perspective, I know coaching is evolving constantly. You know, we're talking about games-based coaching to be the new thing the last sort of decade. But it's a slow evolution in the GA. And is it just the way the GA is, that it's a slow-moving organisation and a lot of things it does, that as I said, the coach on the line, what will become fanciful next month might be if David Fitzwind is All-Ireland and right, everybody's jumping around the sideline. But if Jim Gavin wins the All-Ireland, fellas are happy to stand on the sideline with their arms folded and feel that's what it is. Is it too much copycatting? Is that a part of the...
There's a little bit of colour, but again, I'd be very encouraged by the evolution that happens. That evolution takes time. A revolution can happen instantly, and very seldom do good things come that quick. It's an evolution. And as coach educators, which we all are, we're trying to have an influence on change, a change of behaviour or improved performance. And of course, there's an indirect link as to how we do that. So when any sports or clubs or bodies find that they have to continue to change, I say, boo the bus, that's the purpose of what you're trying to do. You're trying to have that change all along. John McGarren has a lovely quote about change. He says, who'd be wanting change when change will come without wanting? Now, I'd say to a lot of coaches, if you're coaching, let's say, 8 or 10-year-olds, they're going to get better by you just going down there and letting them play. The next, they're going to get faster, they're going to get stronger, they're going to get more flexible. And because you let them play, technically and tactically, they're going to get better. Who'd be wanting change when change will come without wanting? The thing about change is you could have change for good or change for bad. And they talk about control the controllables, which is a nice little phrase and it's been used a lot. But I think really in sport, where it is a measure of, there's a competitiveness to it, a struggle. You have to influence the things you don't control. You have to have a fair influence on that. So I think embrace the change. It's part of what we do. But what are the ways in which you actually implement that change best? And Cullum, I've used the example many times of the recipe and the ingredients. Coaching and that tool to implement change is the recipe. The ingredients are your player pathway, your strength and conditioning, your technical things, your drills, your variety, your video analysis, all those other distractions, if you like. Now, you need them. You need the ingredients. But by God, you need the recipe. And what I have found in my time, 65 now, while the ingredients have sexied up at times, your strength and conditioning. I was a trained PE teacher, it was never mentioned. Video analysis, wow, nutritional play, wow. When I was back with Lara Foley, if any of these things were mentioned, you know. But the recipe for personally engaging with the person you were coaching, for that effectiveness to still be maintained, that hasn't changed. We coach people who play football. We coach people who run, jump and throw. The ingredients we may need, with the ingredients we do need to help them do that, have changed. Who'll be wanting change. But the actual recipe or means in which we engage with people to arouse an enthusiasm in them, to direct them towards ways which they will persist, where they will commit, where they will concentrate, where they will obsess in a holistic way, those ways haven't changed. And I think villages and towns had a granny or a grandmother who was never called a coach, but they had these kind of recipes. They were the people went to for help. Now, they're the ingredients that the great coaches have. They can help when help needs to be given. And then they go back. They wait for you to come to them again a wee bit. We in emphasizing coaching too much, Cullum, I think the change that has happened is that if you give the analogy of kids coming down, they can't do anything until the coach is ready. The cones have to be done, the whistle have to be ready, and now we start. You know, if they run out and play 2v3 or a ball each, come back. Why? It's all about them, you know. So I welcome the change. I'm excited by change. It's going to happen. I'm conscious there could be change for good or change for bad. So we have to have an influence on that. And the main people who are influenced are the kids in front of you. Where there's a lot of talk about their readiness and player pathway. And this readiness is what you see in the faces in front of you any day. Now, let's get today done. And we worry about the next day. And now we see where that brings us. And a lot of the films that you have referred to earlier on, there's a lot of them about teams that have been down in the doldrums and suddenly the change and the improvement happens. And good God, look up where we've landed. So we really get excited by change when it comes in a direction we like. And we worry about it when the pace of it may not be as great. We love the change of the morning. We love the change of the evening. But yet we kind of say, oh, gee, the days are going awful quick or whatever. So I embrace change, try to have an influence on it, and really, really be as patient as what you're trying to hope your athletes will be as well, because it's going to take a long time, a lifelong time to enjoy it.
I remember being at a workshop you were giving before, Liam, and you were talking about a poker player you were involved with.
Oh, yeah, Andy Black.
And he, I asked you at the end, I said, what would a poker player need with a coach? And you were saying that he used to just come and talk, and he might be talking to you for X amount of time, and then at the end of it, he'd come back and say, I got nothing off you today.
That's right. You remember well.
Yeah, and I thought to me, I said, yeah, it's great. I remembered it because I said, we don't have to overpower people information, because they might get nothing from you whatsoever by just loading onto them. And they have to, as you said there, if they want help, they come looking for it. And then you might be able to help them again. They mightn't take anything from it, and so be it. But I remember it well, yeah.
But look at the effect it had on me, Mossy. And there were occasions where it did happen two in a row. But you go away that day, and from the moment you go away until the moment you come back, you're searching for another way. That it didn't work. It didn't work. He clearly said that. The other big learning I had with Andy, when I said one day off the cuff, I'm going to learn how to play poker. And he reacted like I was going to hit him. He said, don't. And he explained that if he couldn't consciously describe to me what he was going to do, because I had no way of filling the gaps, because he really hadn't an in-depth knowledge of it himself. He might have had an unconscious, I filled in those unconscious gaps with my knowledge of it. And so the two of us said, oh, yeah, I know what you mean, Massey, when we didn't. So they were meaningful and effective learning situations. But we don't allow a lot of our players the opportunity to say that. I've learned nothing. In sports where we can measure, and athletics will be one of those, we can see that improvement is taking place within the tangible things of the run, the jump, the speed. But we don't often look for the other improvements, the enjoyment they get, maybe the time they go to bed. What kind of a person is going home? What kind of a person is going to work? Are we developing a person who's far more effective in the community and improving in their sport? Or are they improving in their sport and chaos all around them? Coaches have this holistic view to take on the person, so that there's a big challenge there. You call yourselves the Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast.
Yes.
I don't know why, but I love Roy Orbison, and I use him in a sports context. The stories I like, you know, there was one day he forgot a set of glasses he had, and there was only a pair of sunglasses, and he was very shy, and he wore the sunglasses. He couldn't see the audience as well, and he thought, God, give me that. I'm a lot more comfortable now, and he wore the sunglasses. But I love Pretty Woman, I love Crying, but I love a song called Running Scared. It has no chorus in it. It ends on a high note. And it's really about a fella who is worried that his present girlfriend's ex-boyfriend will come along and take her away. And it's building up. The music is like a heartbeat. Boom, 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 boom. And it comes for the last verse, you know. There he is. You know, so full of himself, his head in the air, and it builds and builds, and she turns around and walks away with me, boom, 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 end, you know. And I love it because it actually uses the word afraid to lose, and it builds and it builds and it builds. And really, when you take a lot of sports people, there is this idea of afraid to lose, false evidence appearing real, fear, F-E-A-R. And here he was, he wasn't trusting the relationship. He wasn't believing in her. And all the time he was infested this fear. Oh, he's going to come along. And look, God, he's there. But bingo, she comes away with him. So he had messed up on all that time of worry. But it's running scared. It's a great one. It builds and builds and builds. And I think it mirrors a lot of the anxieties that we can allow infect us in sport, infect the joy. We're more aware now because of the COVID that we don't know what's going to happen next week or next month. But we never knew what was going to happen next week or next month. Never, ever. Now we're aware of it. So anxieties have popped up. What do we do? Well, we do what we have to do today. Do what we have to do tomorrow. Some change will come about that we have we cannot influence. Some changes will come about that we can. But it's not about running scared. Face up to what we have and let's get on with it. As long as what we get on with is productive and effective and meaningful. And sport gives us wonderful lessons in that in many, many ways. And it also gives us, I think, a far truer demonstration of people who have managed their lives in that way. Because away from the routine of life, you have seen people going through very, very physical, public ups and downs in sport. And you can see the resilience, you can see them succeeding or losing and the way they conduct themselves. Dave Moorcroft does a lovely session in the film, and I don't want to ruin it or anything, but the Dave Moorcroft one is worth looking at. Rugby is a sport I don't understand too much, but I do watch it. And I've been watching Johnny Sexton over the last few games. He's been hammered, he's been banged. He hasn't finished in many, many of them. But yesterday's game, not only did he get hammered and banged, he finished. And right at the death, right at the 80th minute, he had to pop over a penalty from way out. And he did it. So sport gives us access to these kind of wonderful occasions. Will it mean he'll do it again? No, but he did it that time. So it inflames this, it fans this flame. And again, I've used it recently where I did think my role was to light the flame in coaches, light the flame. Now I look back and I know I've never had to light it anywhere. I had to just fan it. They had it already. And how can we do it? So that's why pieces like 16 Days of Glory, they move me and I can reconnect to them. The Naftalu Timu, the Muhammad Gamudi. I'm in another place. And I don't want sport to lose that. I want it to stay with that connection. I want it to stay pure. I don't want the influences of money or drugs or whatever. And it's not just being an old timer. I do feel that the DNA of sport is strong enough to return to those. I think there's a good from Trump's presence in America that it reactivated thinkers who thought this normality will happen have been re-engaged. They're commenting more, they're writing more, they've come out in public more to get things back in a balance. So what we have that holds dear is strong. It won't lose its strength as long as we keep fueling it. And the people who visit sport for the values of money or short-term hits, they'll get fed up if things become longer. If they're not making the much as much, they go somewhere else. And we can still have the same purity that we always had.
Very good. Anything else to add on the film there, lads, Arnie?
No, as I say, it's just really enjoyed the stories. The Albatross is another great story in it. The swimmer who was very close to getting the 3 gold medals on the one day. Like, what an achievement that would have been. And just exhaustion really just cost him the end.
John Benoit in the marathon, you know, women were only allowed to run up to the 800 quite recently. Irish schools athletics, women ran, the girls ran in Irish school only as recently as 1970. Now, I'm of an age to think, wow, you could go to a school's athletic events and there were no girls. Why? They weren't allowed. It's only as recently as 1970. Now they're run nearly as fast as the men, some of them. But that John Benoit won, Greta Weitz, who won the World Cross in Limerick in 79. She was expected to. Here was the first marathon. Here we are, the greatest iconic distance runner we've ever had. Didn't happen. John Benoit just took off and never came back. These little vignettes, as I said, captured in 10-minute things, they're great, yeah.
One of my favourite ones was Connie Carpenter in the cycling. And the fact that 12 years ago she had been a She'd been an Olympian speed skater in the Winter Olympics. And just the fact that, and you see it a lot of time, and you even see it in one of the other ones where someone went from being South American to British just to compete in the Olympics. And that beauty of just being like, and it doesn't matter if you get knocked out in your qualifying heat, or you win a gold medal, you're an Olympian if you get there. Mm-hmm. And it is like, it's a fierce, proud and strong name to have. Like even that Connie Carpenter one, like she was so ruthless. Mm-hmm. Like, so obviously like her biggest competitor was also American. And they were riding, helping each other get through the race in the peloton. And then after 79 kilometers, there's an inch between them at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an inch separates the winner and the loser. And it's just that one really done it for me, just because of the pure mindset of her. Like, it was just...
I love Paul. We see them in their own places. We see them in their own training venues, often their own gym, their own home, their own kitchen. We see them out of athletic gear. We see that they're ordinary people doing this special thing. That appealed to me a lot. I don't actually remember her, the cyclist, now. So it's funny the way these sport being motion and emotion, emotionally it can connect in some ways. That didn't connect to me at all. Yeah.
You must watch a short version, Liam. You can watch the full 4.5 hours.
It's a warning for anybody who does go. There are 4 and 6 hour versions of this, but it's about the 95-minute one that's just the one where it has these little episodes all the more. But you can YouTube some of these. If you YouTube, you'll get them in little hits, all right?
I'd say there was patches in YouTube and the whole thing was in YouTube. One of my favorites was the Japanese judo fighter, just when his ankle was whatever injury he got in the quarterfinal, but he was just so skilled at doing it that he was able to overcome his injury to, like, I don't know, was it 200 matches unbeaten in a row or something like that? Just an unbelievable record. And you're just thinking, God, if he gets to the Olympic final, and his ankle, an injury costs him what probably was his ultimate goal. I suppose it just shows the fine lines between in sport that, like, as Paul said about the inch and the cycling, but as I said, it could just be an injured ankle in the quarterfinal might cost somebody what their destiny was, you know?
That judo was really interesting as well. Like, Iamasta was his name, and he got injured. And it was the standard in judo that you didn't attack the injured part of your opponent if they were injured in the bout. But yet in the Olympic final, his opponent went at the injury and Iamasta still won. And it was very much, even despite going against the morals and the ideals of the contest, the champion still was the champion.
Great respect in it, yeah. It's about discipline, really. Yeah. I was very lucky to become a friend of Pat Hooper. Pat ran in the Moscow Olympics with his brother Dick, the first brothers ever to compete in the Olympic marathon. And a few years later, on a Monday, I was free in art school from 10:30 until 2:30. And many of those Mondays I'd have ran 20 miles around the Hill of Howth with Pat. I'd put my hand up and say, to be seen on the road with Pat, it gave me a lift, you know. Now my tongue might have been hanging out as well, you know, but it did give me a lift. It was balanced a little bit by many times Pat had done a 30 mile on the Sunday. So here he was, and he'd do a 15 that night. But I asked him once if he ever got nervous in races, you know, and it took him a while. We were running along the road. We weren't talking then. He says, oh yeah, in the Olympic marathon, as they left the stadium, Pat had a plate with a false tooth on it. And he realized, gee, I forgot to take out the plate. And he never ran a race with the tooth then. So now he's in his Olympics, he has this tooth on, he'd never wear it. But about 3 miles into the race, he saw an Irish person on the road. He didn't know them, but he knew they were an Irish person. And he took out the tooth again, and ran, and on he went, you know. Because of the security in Moscow, Pat was going out every night and going to where the Irish was collected to meet this fella, to give him back his tooth. And eventually he met him, and your man says, "Oh yeah, I have it." And he just took it out of his pocket and handed it back to Pat. So these Olympians, they're wonderful people, but they're ordinary too. And they make this, they chop and change between that. And that's what I mean by this, for all our sports people, for ordinary fellows like me to be able to be with them, talk to them, get to know them. That's, we need something that they rise to so that we can, we can get part of the shine, part of the heat, you know.
One thing I can't actually let the film go without saying it. So Liam, I have an awful affliction for Adidas gear in the films we have a look at. And there was actually so much in this film that was class. So I'm going to do a top three of Adidas gear, right? So the Moroccan one comes in third. And I would genuinely ask, if anyone from the Mayo County Board is listening, get 1984 Moroccan gear for the Mayo team and sales will skyrocket. The Brazilian blue and yellow stuff comes in at second, right? Beautiful stuff. But the best by a mile was the white and red Germany gear with the black and yellow crest. Oh, like, I'm Googling it, trying to find out where I can actually buy it. Because it's so nice. And, like, every scene that comes on, every new kind of episode that comes on, I'm looking around going, Jesus, who's wearing what in this one? And, like, I was just really disappointed with the cap of gear the Americans had. some of the Adidas gear. Christ, it was unreal.
See, this is the problem a lot of county teams have, is they've got a fella like Paul on the panel who's only there for the gear. And that's Paul on his podcast. He doesn't care about coaching, he's only there about the gear. Thanks for that, Paul. I'm sure listeners will get to work for you. Liam, thanks very much for your time. As I said, I know we could stay here talking all night, but we might try to get you back maybe for a book review maybe next year or the next few months, because I know you've recommended a book to me. I've read it. Another member is about to start it, and I'll get it up to the third fella for a look as well, because it's, as I don't know, did you say to me that it disgusted you how much he knew about coaching, was what you said about the author.
I'd read a book by Frederick Backman. I'd written A Man Called Ove, or Ove, people pronounce it a different way, completely and utterly different theme and brilliantly written. And then I came across this by chance, and it did frustrate me that this guy could know so much about so much. But the amount of little lessons about life and about people and about coaching, I'd suggest that people read Bear Town and Us Against You with the highlighter and take out lessons for life out of it. It's a cracker, a real one follows the other. Great, great books.
Yeah, I've got the bottom of the pages folded up so I wouldn't get mistaken where I was finishing for the day. But look, Liam, thanks very much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Look, as I said, it was great looking at the film, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Liam.
Yeah, guys. Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favorite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Roy Orbison Tattoo. We appreciate any likes, retweets, comments, and suggestions for future viewings. Next week, we will be watching the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, Survive in Advance, the 1983 North Carolina State Wolfpack coached by Jim Valvano, which stayed alive in the postseason by winning 9 do-or-die games in a row. We will be joined by Derek Wittenberg, who was a star of the team, producer of the show, and truly assist in the last seconds to win the game for North Carolina State. See you next week, everybody.